Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, episode 141, Blood and Water. When Constantine died in 337 AD, he left the empire saddled with an unwieldy five-way power-sharing system that it appears he just sort of hoped would somehow find a way to work. Well, by 340, it had found a way to work. It found a way to work by killing off three-fifths of its members. With the number of living Augusti now down to a manageable two, Constantius II and Constans were able to share control of the Roman Empire for a decade without butting heads with each other too much. That did not mean they were mutually supportive best friends by any stretch of the imagination, but it did mean that they mostly respected the legitimacy of the other, and as each had more than enough to deal with in their own half of the empire, it meant that they were not constantly at each other's throats. In other words, the saber rattling was kept to a minimum, and civil war was avoided. Indeed, when Constantius finally did march west to fight a civil war, it was not to take his brother out, but to avenge his death. Of course, this was not vengeance in the you-killed-my-brother-prepare-to-die sense, so much as the allowing an illegal usurpation would set an unacceptable precedent sense, but still, the death of his brother did spur Constantius to some kind of action, which is about as nice a thing as you can say about these guys at this point in history. But before we can get into all that, we need to zip through the 340s AD, which are something of a lost decade source-wise. We know a few things, but until Ammianus Marcellinus comes along and starts to fill in the gaps, we are unfortunately left with a rather broad brush to help us paint the years of Constantius and Constans' joint rule. But like I said, we do know a few things. Both of the emperors began their newly established joint rule by doing what emperors usually do when they want to cement their legitimacy. They made war on the enemies of Rome. In the west, Constans spent most of 341 and 342 battling uncooperative Franks, and appears to have been mostly successful on those campaigns. In early 343, he abruptly abandoned the Rhine and headed north to Britannia, where he made a rare winter crossing over to the island, leading scholars to surmise that some sort of revolt had broken out that required immediate imperial attention. The revolt cannot have been too big a concern, though, because by the spring, Constans was back in Trier, keeping an eye on the Rhine. During this same period, Constantius operated almost exclusively out of Antioch, and spent most of his time fighting the Sassanid king, Shapur II. As I mentioned last week, this new war between Rome and Persia had technically been initiated by Shapur following the death of Constantine in 337, but we should not forget that it was likely the now-dead emperor's threatening rhetoric that laid the groundwork for this latest round of hostilities. The two great empires fought mostly in Mesopotamia, and their armies were apparently well matched because over the course of what would eventually be 13 uninterrupted years of war, Constantius and Shapur fought at least 9 major battles, and none of them were conclusive. Though, I should mention that none of them are particularly well documented either. Despite all the ambiguity, though, there is one great accomplishment that Constantius can point to. On 3 separate occasions over the course of the Long War, Shapur laid siege to the key fortress city of Nisibis, and on all 3 occasions, he was repelled and forced to withdraw. But as notable an accomplishment as this was, though, it sort of leaves us asking the question of what this whole war was about, if preventing the fall of a city turns out to be the big upshot of it all. To put it another way, for 13 years, blood and treasure was expended in massive quantities on both sides, and in the end, nothing changed, nothing was resolved, and no one benefited. Good work, everyone. Beyond the standard imperial war-making, the two emperors were also kept busy through the 340s by what was fast becoming one of the defining features of imperial rule, Christian church politics. Constantius, as I mentioned last week, sympathized with the Arians and promoted their candidates for bishoprics whenever he could. This theological leaning was on display, for example, when the emperor pushed for the Arian Eusebius of Nicomedia, who had been the one to baptize Constantine the Great, by the way, to take over as the Bishop of Constantinople in 338. But it was perhaps nowhere more on display than in his dealings with Athanasius. I didn't get into this last week, but about 5 minutes after the anti-Arian bishop was returned home to Alexandria by Constantine II, Constantius found cause to return him to exile. There was basically no way the emperor was going to let a man with that much power and that much charisma roam free in his territory stirring up trouble. So, it was back to the west for Athanasius. This would have probably been all well and good from an imperial point of view, except for the fact that Constance had developed into something of a pro-Nicene partisan. As with Constantine II, Constance's religious affinities probably had as much to do with the general pro-Nicene orthodoxy of the Western Church as anything else. But on two separate occasions in the early 340s, Constance met with Athanasius and found him to be a man of admirable virtue who was getting the short end of it from his brother. Constance soon came to the decision that Athanasius was the lawful bishop of Alexandria and that he ought to be allowed to return home and serve as such. But as Constance was hardening his pro-Nicene position, Constantius was hardening his pro-Arian position. In 341, while the emperor was in Antioch, a bishop Eusebius died, and before Constantius could react one way or the other, the clergy in Constantinople elevated the anti-Arian Paul of Constantinople to the bishopric of the capital city. When Constantius found out what had happened, he was livid. Not just because he hadn't been consulted, but because he had already deposed and exiled Paul once before in order to clear the way for Eusebius. Fuming over the appointment, Constantius ordered his master of the horse to go to Constantinople and personally oversee the re-banishment of Paul. But when the commander arrived, he found the people of Constantinople ready to defend Paul's right to the office. So much so that in the heat of the moment, they barricaded him inside his house and then set it on fire. The master of the horse, one of the most senior military officials in the empire, was killed in the blaze. And then, to top things off, his body was dragged through the streets in triumph. I wonder what Constantius is going to think about all this. Constantius, surprisingly, took the news of his top lieutenant's murder in stride and decided to allow the people to have their bishop. Just kidding. When word of what happened reached Antioch, Constantius flew into a rage, saddled up his horse, and double-timed to Constantinople, where he planned to separate as many heads from as many bodies as he could find. When he arrived in the capital, though, he was greeted by a population that seemed so genuinely remorseful, who supplicated themselves so completely that Constantius's anger was tempered. Instead of massacring the whole lot of them then, the emperor settled on cutting their free grain allotment by 50%. It goes without saying that Paul was once again exiled from the city. Satisfied that things had been set right, the emperor returned to Antioch to continue the war against Persia. But that would not be the end of it. Constantius's willingness to exile anti-Arian bishops from his provinces eventually came to affect relations with his brother, and in time lead to the closest brush with civil war the two emperors faced during their decade in office together. The various eastern exiles, including Athanasius and Paul, took up residence in Rome, where they were sheltered and defended by the bishop Julius. Pretty soon, Constance was being hit up from all sides to do something about Constantius's mistreatment of all these good and decent men of God. So in 343, Constance called for an ecumenical council to meet in Sardica to rehabilitate Athanasius and his fellow expatriates. But when the outnumbered eastern bishops determined that the whole thing was rigged against them, they walked out en masse. And as a result, the Council of Sardica not only failed in its stated goal to reunite the church, but it also failed to even make the list of official ecumenical councils. By 346, tensions between East and West came to a head, and after getting the brush off time and again, Constans finally decided that the only way to get his older brother's attention was to threaten war. Allow Athanasius and his compatriots return to the east, or I am going to invade your territory and force you to do it. This threat did indeed get Constantius's attention, and set off a flurry of diplomatic correspondence between Antioch and Sirmium, where Constans had taken up provocative residence. Tied down by his protracted war with the Sassanids, Constantius could not afford to waste political or military capital on theological arguments, and though the thought of allowing Athanasius to return to Alexandria rankled him, Constantius basically backed down and gave in to his brother's demand. When Athanasius returned to Alexandria, he was greeted by the population like a conquering hero and immediately reclaimed the bishopric of the city. For the next 4 years, an uneasy truce would stand between emperor and bishop, until the death of Constans in 350 removed Constantius's impediment to action, and Athanasius was banished once again. But despite the return of so many controversial bishops to their home provinces, the late 340s were pretty much the same as the early 340s as far as the Eastern Empire was concerned. Constantius waged war against Shapur, and Shapur waged war against Constantius. Exactly the same thing that had been going on for the last decade. But in the West, Constans began to slip up. Though he had begun his reign with a great deal of promise, of late he had begun to fall into the same trap that had ensnared previous young rulers. Surrounded by sycophants, the 20-something Augustus of the West was losing touch with reality. The common complaint was that he was giving himself over too much to hunting and banqueting and other extracurricular activities, while neglecting the real business of ruling half the empire. Compounding this problem were charges that he was treating his court and his subjects with unnecessary cruelty. Now, this didn't have to become a problem so large that it would eventually destroy him, but Constans forgot the most basic rule of imperial rule. Make sure the army is taken care of. He was not taking care of the army, and so the army took care of him. If anyone is surprised by what's about to happen, just go and listen to the back episodes again, because it's not like these things haven't happened before. Constans's main problem is that he had become enamored with an elite archery corps who acted as his personal bodyguard, and while he lavished gifts and attention on them, he neglected the officers and soldiers out on the frontiers. They, of course, began to talk amongst themselves about how annoying it was that these pretty boy archers were getting all the love. After a few years of enduring what they felt was supreme disrespect, this talking amongst themselves became more of a clamor, and the leading officers of the Rhine legions began to think seriously about finding a replacement emperor. By 349, a conspiracy had solidified around Magnentius, a popular general who was serving as the commander of the official imperial guard units, as opposed to Constans's unofficial archery guard. According to the legend, Magnentius and some of his fellow officers were gathered for dinner in January of 350 at Augusta Dunham, modern Autun in France, when Magnentius excused himself from the table. Upon the general's return, the other officers noticed that he was draped in a purple cloak. They cheered and hailed him as emperor. And just like that, the West was in revolt. Constans, enjoying himself at some unspecified spot near Augusta Dunham, heard of the revolt and began making plans to resist, until he discovered just how out of touch he had become. Apart from his personal guard and a few members of the court, absolutely no one lined up to defend him. I don't know how popular he thought he was, or even if he cared how popular he was, but it had to have come as a surprise to find out just how unpopular he was. The legions up and down the Rhine immediately joined Magnentius's banner. Constans was all alone. Fearing capture if he tried to pass directly through the Alps, the fugitive emperor made instead for Spain, where he planned to hop a ship to Italy and hopefully regroup. But Magnentius's agents caught up with him in the foothills of the Pyrenees, and Constans was executed. He was somewhere between 27 and 30 years old, and had been in Augustus for almost 13 years. The usurpation of Magnentius and the murder of Constance kicked off a frenzy of activity across the empire. In the Far East, Constantius received word that his brother had been killed, and immediately he began working on a plan to extract himself from his war with Persia so he could personally go put the revolt down. Magnentius was trying to head all this off by asking Constantius to just go ahead and recognize him. After all, the empire needed a strong hand in the West. The Eastern legions were bogged down with a war, so why not just do the sensible thing and let me, a strong and popular general, run things for you out here? But Constantius wasn't having it. You don't get to overthrow a member of the family and just get away with it. Magnentius was right about one thing, though. The Eastern legions were bogged down in a war, so as much as he wanted to, Constantius couldn't immediately pick up and march west. As the emperor worked up a plan to put the war with Persia on hold, however, his sister Constantina, the widow of Hannibalianus, apparently took matters into her own hands and wrote to a general closely allied with the Constantinian family named Vetranio, asking him to take matters into his own hands. As one of the senior commanders of the Danube region, Vetranio was well positioned with a large army to oppose the rising power of Magnentius. Spurred on by the emperor's sister, Vetranio declared himself Augustus in March of 350. Now, Constantius cannot have been too happy about this declaration, but he recognized his own weak position and the need for a powerful ally, and Vetranio, backed by Constantia, was promising to be a powerful ally. So the Eastern Augustus went ahead and accepted the general's self-elevation as legitimate. For now. The rise of Vetranio had the intended effect, and finally put a stop to Magnentius's unchecked expansion. Since being declared Augustus in January, the general had gotten all the provinces in Gaul, Britannia, Hispania, and Italy lined up behind him, and he was looking to press on into Constance's Illyrian territory. If he could nail down Illyria, then it was just a hop skip over to Constantinople. Whether he was actually looking to capture the capital is anyone's guess, but at the very least, the threat would have made his bargaining position that much stronger. But with Vetranio now standing firm against him with the Danube legions at his back, Magnentius was forced to settle for what he had already acquired. There would be no directly threatening Constantinople. Magnentius would have to figure out a different way to convince Constantius to legitimize him. Through the rest of the spring, a stalemate ensued, with Magnentius commanding the west, Vetranio holding down the center, and Constantius desperately trying to get out of Syria. Into this mix, a fourth player emerged onto the stage in June of 350. Nepotianus, the lost nephew of Constantine, suddenly appeared at the gates of Rome backed by a small army of gladiators. Since the Eternal City was by this point a strategic backwater, Magnentius had not garrisoned the city, and his supporters there had to rely on a citizen militia for protection. This citizen militia was no match for Nepotianus's gladiators, and the forgotten prince was basically able to stride right through the gates and declare himself master of Rome. For the next 28 days, it looked like Magnentius might be in real trouble. Not only had he stopped acquiring new territory, but he was already losing territory, and to a random Constantinian cousin and a couple of gladiators, no less. But fortunately for Magnentius, the seizure of Rome only occurred because the general had put the Eternal City pretty far down on his list of priorities. I mean, come on, since when has Rome been the key to anything? So Nepotianus held Rome for exactly the amount of time it took for Magnentius to find out what happened, organize an appropriate response force, and then send it back down the peninsula. Now that he had Magnentius' attention, Nepotianus didn't stand a chance. The professional soldiers of the legions easily bested his gladiators, and Nepotianus himself died in the fighting. This small blip aside, the stalemate between Magnentius, Vetranio, and Constantius continued for most of the rest of the year. until finally the Eastern Augustus hit upon some luck in his dealing with the Persians. It seems that right around this same time, Shapur began having problems of his own. With the bulk of the Sassanid army locked down fighting Rome, unruly Scythians had begun raiding his northern frontier. So, just as Constantius was looking for a way out of the war to go deal with Magnentius, Shapur was looking for a way out so he could go deal with the Scythians. As the winter of 350 approached, the two rival leaders agreed to a temporary ceasefire that would allow them each to pull back from Mesopotamia and go handle business on other fronts. The truce would wind up holding for the next 8 years, until, after finally pacifying his northern borders, Shapur decided to take another crack at Rome. For those of you who are reading ahead, that next round of fighting will be the one that eventually kills Julian the Apostate and leads to Jovian's infamous peace agreement of 363. Truce in hand, Constantius was now ready to march west and crush Magnentius. But as much as he trusted the Persian king to abide by the agreement, he did not really trust the Persian king to abide by the agreement. The emperor, already inclined towards paranoia, was worried that the minute he turned his back, Shapur would jump him from behind. Fearing that the lack of a strong imperial presence would incline the Persian toward just this sort of trick, Constantius decided that he needed a stand-in emperor, someone who would keep the Persians from breaking the peace, provide the backbone the legions needed to maintain their vigil, and, perhaps most importantly, protect Constantius's interests in the east. But with most of his male relatives having been killed off at one point or another, the list of acceptable candidates, read, blood-related candidates, was now down to two, the boys who had survived the massacre of the princes, now 25-year-old Constantius Gallus and his younger brother, 18-year-old Julian. Constantius, of course, chose to elevate Gallus, who was not only older, but he didn't have his head shoved in a book all the time. In a ceremony at Antioch, Constantius formally invested Gallus with the title Caesar and gave him authority over the eastern provinces. To seal the deal, Gallus was wed to Constantina, the outspoken sister of Constantius, who was also the one to so recently prod Vetranio into action. That she was Gallus's own cousin was neither here nor there. Peace with the Sassanids established, and a loyal Caesar holding down the fort in Antioch, Constantius could finally march west and exact the full measure of his revenge on Magnentius. As I said before, it's not necessarily that Constantius was broken up about Constance's death, or even that he thought Magnentius would make a bad ruler. It was just that in a world where his own claim to the throne rested entirely on the fact that he was the blood son of Constantine, well, allowing someone from outside the family into the imperial circle kind of undercut the entire rationale for his own rule. The days of the Tetrarchy with its idealized vision of merit-based advancement were dead, dead, dead. The empire was back to classic kinship rules, where blood runs thicker than water. Next week, Constantius will make sure that everyone gets the message that kinship rules are back in effect, and we will watch as the reign of Magnentius very quickly turns into the short reign of Magnentius. But having reasserted the supremacy of the Constantinian family, Constantius II will soon enough prove that while blood may run thicker than water, that did not mean that at the end of the day, Constantius cared about anyone's blood but his own. Which is to say that we will also get to watch next week as the reign of Constantius Gallus very quickly turns into the short reign of Constantius Gallus. Before we go this week, you know how last week I opened by saying that the tours were an absolutely fantastic time and that we hope to be doing them again very soon? Well, I couldn't be more excited to announce that very soon means October 2011. Version 2.0 of the official History of Rome Roman History Tour is ready to launch and will begin on October 21st, 2011. So if the first round of tours didn't work out for you, then by all means, go to historyofrometour.com and send us an email that says, I'm in. As before, additional tours can be scheduled to accommodate demand, if we have that wonderful problem again, but the October 21st trip is locked in and ready to go. Space is limited, so sign up today. For those of you who just slapped their heads, realizing that there was no way they can make October work, well, you're in luck, because we are also going to go ahead and throw open reservations for a third round of tours that will begin on February the 24th, 2012. Between the October 2011 dates and the February 2012 dates, you can make this work, right? Let's go hang out in Rome and look at cool stuff together. I promise you, it is an absolutely fantastic time. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 142, You've Earned It. Last time, we left off with Constantius II finally headed west after extracting himself from the war with Persia in the winter of 350 AD. It had been almost a year since the Gallic general Magnentius had overthrown and killed Constantius' younger brother Constans, and it was finally, time for the emperor to do something about it. While on his way to dole out some imperial retribution, though, Constantius had to stop along the way to take care of some business. You'll recall from last week that in March of 350, at the prompting of Constantina, the general Vetranio had declared himself Augustus at his headquarters along the Danube frontier. He had made this move specifically to aid Constantius and to counter the rise of Magnentius. But when push came to shove, who knew what his ultimate ambitions were? Or what Constantius' reaction was going to be to Vetranio's self-elevation? So far, the emperor had let it slide because he had been tied up with the war against the Sassanids. But now, who knows? As Constantius approached the Dacian city of Sardica, though, it became obvious that neither man was planning to double-cross the other. The aging Vetranio welcomed 33-year-old Constantius as the true Augustus, and Constantius accepted the welcome without malice. They then traveled together across the province to Nisus, where, on December the 25th, the two leaders mounted a stage before an assembly of troops. The soldiers had been instructed to reaffirm their allegiance to Constantius, and so, right on cue, they reaffirmed their allegiance to Constantius. The emperor accepted their pledge of loyalty and then thanked Vetranio for the good work he had done defending his family's honor. Then, he graciously accepted the general's resignation, not just from the office of Augustus, but from the army completely. There were no hard feelings on either side, but there was absolutely no way Constantius could afford to have a man who had sniffed imperial power remain anywhere near that power. It was just bad for business. Vetranio was allowed to live out the rest of his days as a private citizen, supported by a generous state pension. Constantius then traveled north to Sirmium, where he took stock of the situation on the Danube frontier and made his arrangements for the coming war with Magnentius. Aware that battle would likely be joined in the spring, Constantius called his cousin Gallus to court in March of 351. And formally elevated him to the rank of Caesar for all of the reasons I outlined last week. What's that, you say? You could have sworn that last week I said Gallus was elevated at Antioch in 350 before Constantius even left the east? Well, yes, I did say that, and I was wrong. I misinterpreted something I read while I was writing last week's show, and then when I was writing this week's show, I got to the part in my notes where it said, March 351, Gallus elevated at Sirmium, and began muttering really foul things under my breath. So, sorry about that. Gallus was elevated to the rank of Caesar in March of 351 at Sirmium, and married off to Constantina at the same time. Then he was sent to Antioch to keep an eye on the east while Constantius focused on the west. Now the stage was set for the long-awaited confrontation between emperor and usurper. Except neither commander was stupid and looking to just rush into some battle for the sake of having a battle. Constantius in particular had no interest in plunging into Gaul, and so he remained coyly perched along the Danube, hoping to draw his rival out. I have never read a good explanation for why Magnentius decided to fall for this and march away from his base of power and choose to face the emperor in Pannonia, and the only thing I can think of is that he felt like time was not on his side. He had convinced the legions of the West to back him against Constans, but now they were dealing with the far less hated Constantius. So maybe Magnentius determined that if he waited too long, that enthusiasm for the rebellion would drift and he would become isolated. But that's all just me speculating. All we really know is that he did go to Constantius, rather than forcing Constantius to come to him. But even then, the two rivals maneuvered around each other for the entire campaign season of 351, and it wasn't until September that their armies finally squared off. So, by now, the build-up to this battle had been going on for a year and 9 months. As a general rule, it's usually safe to assume that a big match will never quite live up to the hype, and the longer the hype period, the less impressive the match will seem in comparison. But the Battle of Mursa Major, fought alongside the Drava River, turned out to be a barn burner. True, it did not settle the issue once and for all like all of the advertisements on TV had promised it would, but still, it was one of the bloodiest battles in the history of Roman civil war. And as you know now, that is really saying something. And on top of that, there was even a dramatic betrayal right before the whistle blew that changed the whole dynamic of the fight. The match was likely shaping up to be an equal contest, with each side probably composed of 40,000 to 50,000 men. But at the last minute, one of Magnentius's key supporters, a general named Claudius Silvanus, a general who was so at the center of the rebellion that not only had he been the host at the dinner party where Magnentius had been proclaimed Augustus, but he was also the man who had spearheaded the assault on Rome following Napatianus' attempt to control the city. Well, he decided to defect to Constantius at the last minute. Taking most of the men under his command along with him, Magnentius was left with just 35,000 to square off against the 60,000 Constantius now controlled. But there was no getting out of the battle now. The two sides were locked in, and on the 28th of September, they got down to business. As I said, the resulting battle was one of the bloodiest in the history of Roman civil war. Over the course of the day's fighting, fully half of Constantius's army, some 30,000 men, wound up dead in the field. Which would be really bad for Constantius, until you consider that fully two-thirds of Magnentius's army, some 25,000 men, also wound up dead in the field. The immediate upshot of this raw carnage was that, with only 10,000 men left, Magnentius was forced to fall back across the Alps to northern Italy, and Constantius was able to declare victory. But the longer-term upshot was that, at a time when the empire was under constant attack from all sides, Rome lost 55,000 highly trained soldiers in a single day. I'll leave it to you to do the math on whether you think the Battle of Mursa Major wound up as a net positive for the empire long term. To his credit, though, Constantius did not immediately pursue Magnentius following the battle. And by did not immediately pursue, I don't mean he waited a few days or even a few weeks. No, as Constantius had already demonstrated, he was not so blinded by his desire to crush Magnentius that he was willing to just abandon the rest of the empire to its fate. That is to say, that Constantius had enough foresight to recognize that beating down an internal enemy would be a pretty hollow victory if it meant allowing the external enemies of the empire to overrun the provinces. So he put the war against Magnentius on hold for a full year as he focused his attention on the Danube frontier, and in particular, the Sarmatians. Since the Goths had been pushed back at the close of the crisis years, the Sarmatians had taken their place as public enemy number one along the northern border, and they took advantage of any and all weaknesses they detected in the empire's lines. If Constantius were to simply march off with the remaining legions in pursuit of Magnentius, well, That would be a weakness the Sarmatians would not fail to take advantage of. So for the rest of 351 and almost all of 352, Constantius stayed in Sirmium to focus his attention on stabilizing the border and running a pacification campaign against the Sarmatians. Only after he was reasonably sure that he could turn his back for a little while without the middle of the empire going to hell in a handbasket did Constantius turn his attention back to Magnentius. Between his unwillingness to ditch the eastern frontier in the middle of a war and his unwillingness to push on west before ensuring the Danube region was secure, I gotta say, Constantius has a well-deserved reputation for impulsive hot-headedness, but it was clearly not a personality trait that defined him 100% of the time. At least some of the time, he was patient and far-sighted. In his later dealings with Julian, he will display almost exactly this same temperament. So, you can say a lot of things about Constantius II, but I think it's pretty clear that at the end of the day, the man did have his priorities straight. So, once he was satisfied that the Danube was safe, he marched off through the Alps before the winter of 352 could settle in, and he landed in North Italy, where Magnentius had been waiting for him. Though he was not yet beaten, between the defection of Silvanus and the defeat at Mursa Major, Magnentius was definitely reeling. His legitimacy as a military leader had taken a major hit, but even more troubling was the fact that his political legitimacy was on life support. So when Constantius crossed the Alps, all he really needed to do was pull the plug. The citizens of Italy had lost all interest in helping prop up Magnentius, but they were compelled to continue supporting him because he was the biggest, baddest thing around. As soon as Constantius showed up with his bigger, badder army, though, the locals relished in helping the emperor expel Magnentius' garrisons from their various cities. Magnentius, no dummy, saw which way the winds were blowing and withdrew to Gaul. Constantius then entered Milan, where he spent the winter planning the endgame. As soon as the spring of 353 arrived, the emperor marched north into Gaul, looking to squash the rebel general once and for all. Magnentius waited for Constantius at a picked spot in the Gallic Alps, where the last battle of the war would soon be fought. Despite the significance of this battle, we don't know many details, troop numbers or tactics or anything like that. All we do know is that Magnentius was once again defeated, but once again able to get out of the battle alive. But getting out alive was of small comfort, as it only delayed the inevitable. With two major defeats behind him and his coalition collapsing, Magnentius came to terms with the fact that he had taken his shot at empire and missed. At some point after the final battle, though we don't know exactly when, Magnentius committed suicide by falling on his sword. Following the defeat and suicide of Magnentius, Constantius found himself in a wholly new position. He was the only Augustus in the empire left standing. Sure, he had something of an imperial colleague in Gallus, but Gallus was just a Caesar, so I think it's safe to go ahead and say it. Constantius II was now the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. Congratulations, dude. You've earned it. The now sole emperor spent the rest of 353 and 354 campaigning against the Alemanni, mostly around the no-man's land between the Rhine and Danube rivers. The sweetness of his victory over Magnentius, though, had almost immediately turned sour in Constantius' mouth, as he realized just how much the Rhine defenses had been weakened by the Civil War. Magnentius had pulled men off the frontier to fight his battles, and most of them had never come back. So the real prize of war that Constantius had won for himself was a chaotic and weak western frontier. Congratulations, you've earned that too. He would do his best to get a handle on the situation, but it would be years before the citizens of the West were allowed to breathe easy again. As Constantius was dealing with the Alemanni, he was also forced to pay attention to something his advisors had been trying to get him to pay attention to for a little while now, the conduct of his Caesar, Constantius Gallus. Since his elevation to power, Gallus had set up shop in Antioch, and from almost the word go, complaints had been filtering in about his behavior. When you look at the situation objectively, I don't think Gallus comes off as that terrible a ruler, so much as one who was in the habit of making enemies with the wrong people. That is not to say he was a great guy who was just slandered to death, but there was definitely an influential clique of imperial advisors who hated him and who exploited Constantius's natural paranoia to get rid of him. Oh, did I mention that Gallus is about to be gotten rid of? Well, he is. There were basically two main things that set the stage for the fall of the young Caesar. First, he was faced with a drought, which meant that grain supplies became limited. Gallus, predictably, put the needs of the army above those of the common citizens, so grain deliveries to civilians were cut. This, again predictably, made Gallus not particularly beloved by the man in the street. Second, he had gotten in the habit of zealously persecuting pagans, particularly rich pagans. Which is to say that Gallus appears to have stumbled across that ages-old method of imperial fundraising. Find the richest guy on the block and find him guilty of something. With Gallus making enemies among the rich and poor alike, it was just a matter of time before word reached Constantius that there was a problem with his cousin. Constantius decided to dispatch one of his Praetorian prefects to Antioch to ask Gallus to come to Italy and account for himself. But Gallus was suspicious of the prefect's true motives, and so had him arrested. Members of the local Antiochian political establishment attempted to come to the prefect's aid, but in the ensuing back and forth, evidence of a conspiracy to overthrow Gallus came to light, that, though it had nothing to do with the prefect's arrival, all got thrown into the same pot. Gallus, angry and paranoid, executed the whole lot of them for treason, including the unlucky prefect. And with that, Gallus pretty much signed his own death warrant. Constantius was extremely irate when he found out about the treason trials, and sent another messenger to Antioch. This time, he did not ask Gallus to come to Italy, he ordered Gallus to come to Italy. And this order, as you can imagine, made Gallus really, really nervous. Orders like that, from men like Constantius, usually mean just the one thing. So instead of packing up and heading west, Gallus packed up his wife-slash-cousin, Constantina, and sent her west instead. The presumption is that Gallus was hoping she would be able to soothe her brother enough for Gallus to get out of this with his head still attached to his body. We will never know if this plan was going to work, and there was good reason to think that it would not have worked, since Constantius was likely as angry at Constantina as he was at Gallus at this point for the active role she had played in everything that had gone on. But we will never know, because on the way to Milan, Constantina came down sick and died en route. Hearing of his wife's death, Gallus determined that he wasn't going anywhere, no way, no how. So Constantius, that sneaky Constantius, tried a different tack. He sent another messenger to Gallus, wondering aloud why Gallus had not come to Milan, since all he wanted to do was make him co-Augustus. Gallus, paranoid, but also ambitious, allowed himself to be persuaded that he was actually going to get promoted, even after everything he had done, and so he left for Milan immediately. But along the way, there were subtle clues that the promotion was in fact a ruse. Like, for example, the fact that whenever Gallus' entourage approached, the various legionary garrisons along the way were mysteriously sent out on patrol. This meant that Gallus never got within sniffing distance of a force big enough to help him revolt, should he decide that revolt was actually his best option. Isolated from whatever allies he had left, and any soldiers who might be bribed into protecting him, Gallus was now easy pickings, and while entering the home stretch, the unsuspecting Caesar was picked up in Noricum by Constantius' men at some point in late 354 and placed under arrest. Assured that no harm would come to him, Gallus was escorted down to a city along the Adriatic coast, where some of the most powerful members of Constantius' court came to interrogate him. Unfortunately for the imprisoned Caesar, these men also happened to be the same men who had been pressing Constantius to eliminate Gallus ever since the victory over Magnentius. So yeah, this is not really going to end well for Gallus. The court officials accused the Caesar of all manner of treason, and then tortured him in an attempt to get him to confess to all the things they needed him to confess to. But Gallus took another route and decided to pin every single thing he was accused of on Constantina, who he painted as a conniving shrew who had forced him to do all this rotten stuff. A summary of Gallus's defense was sent to Constantius, who, upon reading the report, blew his top. "This little weasel is trying to blame it all on my sister? Well, that's about it for him." Constantius sent his reply, "Execute the impertinent Caesar." Now, as was typical with Constantius, as soon as the initial fury wore off, he mellowed and sent another order that Gallus not be killed, and instead brought directly to Milan for further questioning. After all, it's not like Constantina was the Virgin Mary or something, so maybe the kid did have a point. But Constantius's men knew their boss well, and knew that as likely as not he was going to rescind the execution order when he calmed down, so they wasted no time. Gallus was put to death the minute the execution order arrived. He was 28 or 29 years old and had been Caesar for 3.5 years. When Constantius learned that Gallus had been put to death, he probably regretted that his counter-orders had not gone out quick enough to save his cousin, but I seriously doubt he lost much sleep over it. Gallus, as a person, had never really been much of anything to Constantius. But it did leave the emperor with a problem, because, after all, he had elevated Gallus for a reason, to maintain an imperial presence in the Far East. Wintering in Milan over the winter of 354-355, Constantius had to have been at least a little nervous now that the volatile border with the Persians was left unmanned. But the only male member of his family left, the emperor had no sons of his own, was the bookish and completely inexperienced Julian. Constantius had already elevated one inexperienced cousin to the purple, and look where that had gotten him. So I think he can be forgiven for hesitating a bit before wanting to do it all over again. As the spring of 355 turned into the summer of 355, though, a crisis popped up that likely pushed Constantius decisively into favoring the elevation of Julian. Well, alleged crisis, anyway. See, one of Constantius's flaws, and there were a few flaws, was that he was too quick to believe whatever he was told, especially in matters of conspiracy, sedition, and revolution. His court advisors had picked up on this, and so any time a personal enemy of some senior official needed to be taken care of, well, let's just say that it wasn't too hard to convince Constantius that these personal enemies were, in fact, public enemies. And so it went for Claudius Silvanus. After defecting to Constantius at the Battle of Mursa Major, Silvanus had been rewarded with the command of the Rhine legions, where he had served the emperor faithfully. This did not mean he was a saint. Silvanus always made sure that he got his cut, if you know what I mean. But even if he wasn't necessarily honest, he had been faithful. But Silvanus had made enemies within Constantius's inner circle, and as his power and reputation grew, so too did his ability to threaten that inner circle. So they determined to get rid of him. In a very cloak-and-dagger move, they got a hold of a letter Silvanus had sent to a friend in Rome, sponged out some innocent lines, and rewrote them to make it look like Silvanus was drumming up support for a possible rebellion. Then, they forged a further series of letters that appeared to confirm Silvanus's guilt. Then, they waved all of this in the emperor's face and demanded he do something about it. As paranoid as Constantius was, though, he was surprised enough by the charges that he decided to investigate. Silvanus, of course, denied everything, and dispatched a couple of top aides to Milan to rebut the charges the minute he heard what the unscrupulous courtiers were up to. In a sad twist of fate, Silvanus' aides were able to prove the letters fake, but in the meantime, their general had gotten jumpy. Convinced that Constantius was going to find him guilty one way or the other, Silvanus decided that if he was going to be executed for treason, he may as well commit some treason. In the summer of 355, he declared himself Augustus and prepared for war. Not too long after this declaration, though, a message arrived from the emperor ordering Silvanus to come to Milan at once. Under normal circumstances, this would have been rightfully considered a death sentence. But the man who bore the message, a general named Ursicinus, gave Sylvanus hope. Ursicinus and Sylvanus shared a loathing for Constantius's inner circle. So the fact that the emperor had used him to bear the message meant that Sylvanus may yet survive. Indeed, the contents of the message indicated that Constantius did not even realize Sylvanus had gone ahead and declared himself Augustus. So, Sylvanus agreed to follow Ursicinus to Milan. But the crafty Constantius, that crafty Constantius, who did in fact know about Sylvanus's revolt, had used Ursicinus specifically because he knew Sylvanus would drop his guard. On the way to Milan, Sylvanus was arrested and put to death. Executed for treason only because he had been framed for treason. That is a hard luck case. The Sylvanus episode didn't really have too many long-term repercussions for the empire, but it probably did play a role in Constantius's final decision to go ahead and elevate Julian to power. Between tribal incursions along the Rhine, the possibility of war with Persia, and the ever-present threat of a revolt, Constantius knew he needed an imperial colleague to help him handle it all, and that said colleague had better be a member of the family, because no one else could be trusted. So next week, we will get our first look at the man Enlightenment philosophers and neo-pagans everywhere crush so very hard on, Julian the Apostate, the last emperor to attempt to stem the rising tide of Christianity. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 143, Julian the Pre-Apostate. After defeating Magnentius, dispensing with Gallus, and putting down the recent revolt of Sylvanus, for the first time in a long time, Constantius II was completely secure on the throne. But with everything that had gone on the last few years, it must have felt like the most insecure security in the world. Like that at any moment some chunk of the empire could slip away and bring Constantius crashing down with it. Opportunistic German tribes had taken advantage of the shaky Rhine defenses, leaving the West awash in barbarian invaders. The Sarmatians were a persistent source of trouble along the Danube, and it seemed like the Sassanids would come crashing back into Mesopotamia at any moment. So while Constantius had to have been happy that he now was the sole and unchallenged ruler of the empire, he also had to have been more than a little wary about what the future had in store for him. With all of this weighing on his mind, the emperor finally decided in November of 355 to elevate the last male member of his family to the purple, and hoped the young man would be able to help shore up that insecure security Constantius was wrestling with. It was obvious that at this stage in history, the empire absolutely needed multiple emperors fighting on multiple fronts to keep the whole project from falling apart, and so enter Julian the Apostate. Julian had been born in 331 or 332 AD in Constantinople, and as we've already seen, he managed to survive the massacre of the princes by virtue of the fact that he was too young to pose any immediate threat. After the massacre, Julian was shipped off with his brother to Bithynia to live with their maternal grandmother, and he appears to have had a happy few years living in comfortable pseudo-exile. His education was overseen by the bishop Eusebius, the same bishop Constantius had pushed to take over Constantinople in 338, and a Gothic eunuch named Mardonius. After Eusebius died in 341, Julian and Gallus were packed off to an imperial estate in Cappadocia, and there was nothing pseudo about this exile. Far from the cosmopolitan centers of the empire, the villa in Cappadocia became a prison that young Julian only managed to escape by means of the collection of books he was allowed to accumulate. Studying anything that seemed even mildly interesting, Julian became enamored with Greek philosophy and the pagan cults of old. though he was always careful to focus first and foremost on Christian texts to avoid any unpleasant questions about where his heart might be drifting. In 348, probably because he already had his eye on them as potential heirs, the sonless Constantius recalled his cousins from their Cappadocian exile. Gallus likely spent some time in Ephesus before settling in at Constantinople, while Julian spent the next 2 years bouncing between the capital and Nicomedia, furthering both his classical and Christian education by studying with the greatest teachers of his age. Following the revolt of Magnentius, the universe fired a warning shot across Julian's contemplative bow when he found himself present in Sirmium to witness his brother's elevation to the rank of Caesar. It is one thing to be the kept relative of a distant Augustus. It is quite another to be the brother of a Caesar. The political waters were lapping at Julian's heels. But they would not drown him just yet. And for the next few years, he was allowed some freedom of movement to continue his studies. So he traveled up and down the Anatolian coast, where he sought out the great masters of philosophy and rhetoric and even magic. It was at this point, round about 351 or 352 AD, that Julian turned decisively away from Christianity. Now, there was no real dramatic moment of conversion where Julian lights a bundle of scripture on fire and declares himself the enemy of Christianity for all time. It was just that during this period, the scales of belief tipped away from Christianity and towards paganism. Julian knew Christian scripture backward and forward, and had always been troubled by its many contradictions. And so now, he embraced an alternative theology. The classical philosophy he read and the pagan cults he encountered were exciting, and most likely they simply offered Julian a more satisfying explanation of the cosmos than he found in Christian teachings. I should note, though, that a few armchair psychologists have argued that Julian's rejection of Christianity may have stemmed from the fact that his devoutly Christian cousin Constantius had, you know, murdered his entire family. But I think that's unnecessary. I just think Julian was a whip-smart 20-year-old who turned his back on the traditional religion of his family in order to pursue more exotic belief systems. Things like this happen literally every single day, so I don't think we need to bring the trauma of his childhood in to explain why Julian ultimately turned his back on Christianity forever. I have to imagine that the years in between Gallus' rise and Gallus' fall had to have been the happiest of Julian's life. He was young, mostly free to come and go as he pleased, and he was surrounded by exciting new ideas. For a reserved intellectual like Julian, this had to have been something close to heaven, enjoying the perks of his imperial connections without any of the political or military entanglements. However, when the Gallus affair climaxed with the execution of his brother, the idyllic life of Julian ended, and something far more complicated took its place. As the last remaining male relative of Constantius, he was called to Milan shortly after his brother's death in late 354 so that the emperor could size him up, figure out if he was dangerous first of all, and then figure out if maybe Julian could handle the job of Caesar should the need arise. After his arrival in the Italian capital, though, he was kept under a sort of house arrest. He wasn't allowed to leave, but neither was he ever summoned to meet with Constantius. So, is he going to kill me like the rest of my family? Is he going to let me go? Like, what's the deal here? This limbo persisted a good 7 months, and it was not until mid-355 that Constantius finally decided to have a look at the boy. Julian had done his best to adopt a non-threatening posture throughout his life, and after meeting with the emperor, Julian was relieved to discover that this posture had shown through. His confinement in Milan did not in fact turn out to be him just sitting on death row. Constantius decided to let his cousin leave Italy to continue his education. His life having just flashed before his eyes, though, Julian took this opportunity to visit the only city a burgeoning young intellectual absolutely must visit before they die, Athens. He received permission to travel to the ancient city and departed at once. Eager to take in everything that Athens had to offer, he studied at the feet of the Greek masters and was inducted into the Eleusinian Mysteries. But at the end of autumn 355, just 3 months after arriving, Julian learned that his days as a professional student were about to come to an end. Or maybe Constantius had reconsidered, and it was his life that was about to come to an end. Julian, reluctantly, and most likely fearfully, returned to Milan. As I'm sure you can probably guess, though, Constantius had not called Julian back to Milan to kill him. No, he had a far worse fate in store for the cerebral 23-year-old. On November 6, 355 AD, Constantius assembled the troops and announced that he was making Julian his Caesar. The troops cheered, Julian cringed, and the empire had itself a new junior emperor. And what would the new junior emperor's assignment be? How about ridding all Gaul of its German invaders and returning peace and security to the western provinces? Think you can handle that? This throw-him-in-the-deep-end-and-see-if-he-can-swim mentality has been taken by some to indicate that Constantius didn't really care if Julian sank or swam. If the kid pulls it off, then great. The empire is that much better for it. But if it turns out he's in over his head and gets killed in the fighting, well, that takes care of a dynastic threat I'll probably just get all paranoid about in a few years anyway. In other words, sending Julian north was win-win, at least from Constantius's point of view. As Julian left for Gaul, I can very much picture the bookmakers of the empire taking odds as to whether the young Caesar was going to come back alive. He had no military experience and no political experience. So, if the Germans didn't stab him in the front, then surely some cutthroat advisor is going to stab him in the back. Just look at what had happened to his brother. When the new Caesar arrived in Gaul in his ill-fitting military attire and accompanied by an entourage whose loyalty first and foremost was to Constantius, no one figured that he stood a chance. But to everyone's surprise, Julian decided not to mess around with this thing. If he was going to be Caesar, then doggone it, he was going to be Caesar. Much as I'm sure part of him wanted to sit in his tent reading books while other men took care of his business for him, Julian refused to fall into that trap. The parallels to Marcus Aurelius on this point are interesting, and I often think that in Julian, we get a chance to see what a 20-something-year-old Marcus would have been like as an emperor had not Antoninus Pius inexplicably reigned for like 150 years. Both men were much more inclined temperamentally to intellectual pursuits, but forced into action, both refused to shirk their duty, and they took seriously their role as a military leader. It speaks well of both of them. Over that winter of 355-356, Julian threw himself into the soldier's life, commandeering a drill sergeant and forcing himself to do everything a new recruit would be expected to do. The senior officials surrounding the young leader, military and political alike, were surprised at his dedication, but still, they probably were snickering behind his back. This pampered prince was no soldier. Who did he think he was kidding? At the end of this no doubt stirring montage, though, Julian was in shape and ready for action. He had no intention of sitting on the sidelines or being a mere figurehead. He was going to lead the legions into battle. If people didn't think he was up to it, well, he was just going to have to prove them wrong. The only question left was where to start. As I touched on last week, the revolt and subsequent defeat of Magnentius had left the Rhine defenses in shambles. Cities were under-garrisoned, watchtowers were left unmanned, and the general focus of everyone had been on the internal threat of Constantius rather than the external threat of the Alemanni and the Franks. The Germans picked up on this pretty quickly, and in the 5 years since Magnentius had donned his purple cloak, the Romans had been pushed back off the Rhine River, losing control of a good number of cities in the process, including Cologne, the capital of Germania Inferior. So Julian's first task was clear: march to the Lower Rhine and retake the lost urban centers along the river. For all of 356, Julian campaigned against the Germans and emerged victorious from a series of decently sized encounters. As winter approached, Julian had succeeded in driving off the occupying Germans and retaking, among other cities, the great military capital of Cologne. It was a fantastic start to his career, though I would be negligent in my duties if I didn't point out that defending walled cities was not exactly the Germans' forte. They withdrew at the first sign of serious pushback from the Romans. But still, a good first day for the new Caesar. The winter would bring Julian's first taste of real hardship. After scattering his men across Gaul in winter quarters, Julian himself set up shop with a small garrison in the city of Sinon. Julian, confident that the year's campaign had put the Germans on notice, was expecting no trouble. But as soon as he was settled, an army of Franks suddenly appeared at the gates of the city. It was not a large army, but it was bigger than any force Julian could muster right at that moment. So, direct counterattack was out of the question. That said, the city's defensive fortifications were sturdy. So, it looks like if the Germans want a siege, then a siege is what they are going to get. The Germans apparently had no problem with this, and so a siege is what they got. For the next month, Julian was trapped inside the city, unable to break out, but also unwilling to give up. Now, the Siege of Sinon raises a huge question. What in the world was Marcellus doing during all of this? Who was Marcellus, you ask? Well, he was Julian's master of the horse, who was stationed just 100 miles away, with an army big enough to easily drive off the besieging Germans. He knew what was happening, and yet he did nothing. He had his excuses, but really, dude, what is so important that you can't pop down and rescue the freaking Caesar of the Empire? Which is exactly what Julian wanted to know after the Germans got tired of the stalemate and withdrew. Marcellus, as I said, has his excuses, but there was absolutely no doubt in Julian's mind that he had been hung out to dry by a disgruntled subordinate, and he wrote to Constantius telling the emperor exactly that and demanding that Marcellus be removed from his post. Marcellus countered by writing a letter of his own, explaining why he had failed to do anything about the siege, but confirming, at least in my own mind, that Marcellus was full of it and had indeed intentionally left Julian hung out to dry, Constantius sided with his Caesar, and Marcellus was banished to the Danube frontier. Once the spring of 357 arrived, Julian was ready to put the winter struggle behind him and go on the offensive. In coordination with his master of the infantry, a general named Barbaccio, Julian planned a two-pronged invasion of Alemanni territory along the Upper Rhine. Julian would march due east, while Barbaccio, currently in Milan, would march north through Raetia. They would then meet in Alemanni territory and deliver some stern reprisals to the Germans for running amok in Roman territory. But the flying pincer move Julian envisioned fell apart immediately. It started out well enough, but as Julian advanced, a German army crossed the Rhine and attacked the key Gallic city of Lugdunum, forcing Julian to stop and come to the city's aid. Barbaccio, meanwhile, was about to prove himself to be either incompetent or sinister, or maybe both. Not only had he allowed the Germans now attacking Lugdunum through the line in the first place, but when they were finally driven off by Julian, Barbaccio let them waltz right back through, despite a clear warning from Julian that fugitive barbarians were headed his way and weighed down with captured treasure. As if this wasn't bad enough, a few weeks later, Julian was fighting with the Alemanni and struggling to cross the Rhine, and he requested Barbaccio send him 7 boats to help him make the crossing. Barbaccio was in the process of building a pontoon bridge of his own, and with more than enough boats at his disposal, Julian figured the master of the infantry could spare him a few. But when he got the request, get this, rather than give Julian 7 boats, Barbaccio burned 7 boats, which just doesn't make sense on any level. So then Julian found a fordable spot in the river and managed to drive off the Alemanni he had been facing, but when he looked around for Barbaccio, who should be in the area any second now, he discovered that his master of the infantry had been outsmarted and that the Germans had destroyed his pontoon bridge, and so Barbaccio was still on the Roman side of the Rhine. Left alone in German territory, Julian prudently fell back. Undeterred, the Caesar set about trying to salvage the campaign, and so he called for additional grain supplies from the south. But rather than allow these grain supplies to pass through, Barbaccio, again, get this, burned the carts they were being transported on, claiming that he was afraid the shipments would fall into enemy hands. Then, unilaterally deciding that the year's campaign season was over, Barbaccio withdrew back to Milan, leaving Julian exposed to a swarm of stirred-up Germans. So, what exactly was Barbaccio's deal? Ammianus Marcellinus, the soldier historian who was serving in the legions at this point, summed it up nicely when he said, "It is unresolved whether he, that is Barbaccio, committed so many monstrous acts as a result of his own vanity and self-destructiveness, or prompted by orders of the emperor." Coupled with Marcellus's conduct the previous winter, it does not seem exactly out of the question to wonder if Julian's various commanders had been given explicit instructions by the emperor to undermine his Caesar at every opportunity. But Constantius did want the Germans bottled up, and he had sent Julian to spearhead the operation, so it seems a little weird that he would simultaneously try to trip him up. If he wanted Julian dead, why not just kill him like he had killed everyone else? In all likelihood, then, Marcellus, Barbaccio, and the others were simply ticked off about having to take orders from some untested youth playing soldier, and when they saw chances to undermine him, they took them. That, and Barbaccio, appears to have been kind of an idiot. But despite their efforts, Julian would not be undermined. Indeed, it was right at this low moment, ditched by Barbaccio and left stranded near Strasbourg with an undersized and ill-supplied army, that Julian won his greatest victory. A German king named Conodomar, I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that right, took the success the Alamanni had been having that year as an opportunity to forge a coalition of six tribes and lead them on a massive offensive. As Julian hunkered down with the 13,000 soldiers he had left, reports came in that some 35,000 Alamanni were crossing the Rhine River and heading straight for him. Julian, choosing to force the issue now rather than face battle after a retreat that would likely completely exhaust his already exhausted army, ordered his men forward. Though the Romans were outnumbered, and by Romans I of course mean the Germans fighting for Rome, the discipline that had always been the legion's calling card was still a decisive factor, and at the Battle of Strasbourg, Julian had some of the best troops in the whole empire at his disposal. The turning point in this battle likely came before the first shot was even fired. Always hyper-protective of the egalitarianism that they felt defined them, the German troops demanded that Conodomar and the other chiefs dismount from their horses and fight on foot with everyone else. Bowing to public pressure, the German king complied, but in so doing, he lost his mobility and any sort of ability to run a coherent attack. But then again, with 35,000 fighting 13,000, how coherent does your attack really need to be? Things started out well for the Germans, as they managed to turn back Julian's initial cavalry assault on their left side. Heartened by this success, the middle of the German line surged forward, and the bloody business of raw hand-to-hand fighting commenced. Eventually, the sheer weight of the Germans took its toll, and the German center was cut in two. Normally, this would be death to an army, but both split wings were able to maintain their order and continue fighting as two separate units. Still, things looked pretty dire for Julian and his army until the Roman back reserve line stepped up to the plate. After the Germans cut through the front line, they ran headlong into a solid wall of highly trained veterans who refused to be pushed back and who refused to be split up. So now, rather than emerging on the far side of a victorious charge with nothing left to do but mop up the fractured Roman army, the German foot soldiers found themselves trapped between the solid back line and the two wings of the split front line, who now hemmed them in on either side. If Julian had been able to swing some cavalry around behind them, this all would have resembled nothing so much as the last phase of the Battle of Cannae. So yeah, now things looked pretty dire for the Alamanni. Finally, frustrated and dying by the hundreds, the Germans lost heart and hightailed it out of there. Julian ordered his own army in pursuit, but only to a point. He told his men that when they reached the Rhine, that they were not to get bogged down by climbing into the river. Instead, he ordered them to stay on the banks and just fire spears and arrows at the fleeing Germans. The estimate is that the Alemanni left as many dead in that river as they had on the battlefield. In total, 6,000 Germans died at the Battle of Strasbourg. The Romans, amazingly, lost only 243. The cherry on top of this great victory was when Connemara was tracked down and brought back in chains. Julian dutifully sent the beaten king on to Milan for Constantius to gloat over. The Battle of Strasbourg cemented Julian's reputation as a leader to be reckoned with. His troops now loved him. Constantius's agents now feared him. And that little tick in the back of the emperor's mind, the one that led him to be super paranoid about everyone and everything, especially threats from within his own family, well, that little tick just got real fired up. Next time, we'll watch all of this come to a head as the relationship between Constantius and Julian will break down completely over an order to transfer Gallic troops to the east to help fight the resurgent Sassanids. Were the troops really needed, or was this all just about undermining, there's that word again, a Caesar on the rise? I say next time because I hate to do this to you after just being gone for so long, but I'm flying back home for a week of family fun, and I will have absolutely no time to work on the show. But we'll be back in 2 weeks to watch as Julian's troops, surprisingly, and without any prompting from me, I swear, declare Julian Augustus. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 144, The Road to Constantinople. Julian's first taste of what the future had in store for him came immediately after the Battle of Strasbourg in 357 AD. Having just routed a German army that outnumbered them 3-1, and suffering only minimal losses while doing it, the Roman soldiers under Julian's command were understandably exuberant. So exuberant that when Julian emerged to address them following the battle, the troops spontaneously hailed him as Augustus. This seditious offer hung in the air for a heartbeat before the 25-year-old Julian swatted it down harshly. "My cousin Constantius is Augustus," he told him, "and I will not, under any circumstances, allow you to elevate me in opposition to him." This closed the matter for the moment, but after another 2.5 years of rising tensions between Julian and Constantius, the young Caesar would eventually change his mind and allow his army to give him what they wanted to give him. That said, Julian's actions following the victory at Strasbourg went a long way towards convincing the troops that maybe attempting to elevate their Caesar had actually been a bad idea. Sitting right on the line between fall and winter 357, the Roman soldiers assumed that, feather in cap, Julian would order them to a well-deserved winter's rest. But the young general decided instead that now was the best time to drive the Germans into the ground, so he ordered his army across the Rhine. The troops were incredulous. "Are you kidding? We just beat a horde of barbarians in a battle that by all accounts we should have lost, and now you want us to invade Germany in the middle of winter. You must be kidding." He's kidding, right? But Julian was not kidding, and so over the Rhine the legions went. Julian spent the next few months attacking Alemanni settlements and generally running amok. The Germans were just as surprised to see the Roman soldiers coming as the Roman soldiers were to be coming, and they scattered hastily in the face of these unexpected assaults. Though the winter campaign made Julian supremely unpopular, strategically, it was a complete success. 3 of the 6 German chiefs who had fought against him at Strasbourg were hunted down and forced to submit to Roman authority. In the middle of January, satisfied that he had made substantial gains in the never-ending war for control of the Rhine River, Julian finally ordered his army back to Gaul. Dispersing his men around the province, Julian himself settled into the city of Lutetia, which, by that point, may already have been known by the name that we know it today, Paris. While wintering in Paris, Julian turned his attention to civil affairs, even though, strictly speaking, they were outside of his jurisdiction. Despite the fact that he held imperial office, as Caesar, Julian was technically only authorized to address the military defense of his provinces. This followed from the precedent established by Diocletian separating military from civilian power, and it meant that while Julian was in Gaul, there was another center of political gravity, the Praetorian prefect Florentius. Florentius was not a bad administrator, but like the other senior officials in Gaul, he resented the arrival of the thoroughly self-confident Julian, especially when Julian began sticking his nose in where it did not belong. After 2 years of uneasy power sharing, the two men finally came to blows over the issue of provincial taxation. Both agreed that it was in everyone's best interest to initiate a rebuilding effort across Gaul for the benefit of the civilian population. Both also agreed that, unfortunately, the current tax receipts were not going to cover the effort. So, more revenue was needed. Florentius wanted to simply throw out a supplemental tax to raise the necessary funds. But Julian dug a little deeper into the issue and came away convinced that what they really needed to do was cut taxes. This counterintuitive idea sprang from two basic facts. First, the people who would be hardest hit by the supplemental tax had already paid everything that they could afford that year. There was no wool left to be sheared. Second, the real problem was not that the tax rate wasn't high enough. It was that the taxes weren't being collected properly. For years, the wealthy landowners of Gaul had been hiding inside of a loophole. Every so often, as a sign of goodwill or to celebrate something or another, the government would issue a proclamation canceling out unpaid debts to the state. So the rich men of Gaul simply stopped paying their taxes altogether. If government officials got pushy, a helpful bribe would help turn their heads until, inevitably, a proclamation canceling all old debts would be announced and everyone was dropped back down to zero. The poor and middle classes couldn't afford to pay off the officials, so they were left to cover the expenses of the whole provincial administration. Florentius's supplemental tax would simply hit these classes up for more cash, and it was obvious to anyone who cared to pay attention that they really didn't have any more cash to give. So Julian proposed simply cutting taxes across the board and then actually, you know, collecting what everyone owed. This would lead to greater prosperity and more tax revenue for the government. QED. Florentius was annoyed that Julian was even involved with the issue and really annoyed that Julian was trying to contradict him, and so he immediately wrote to Constantius complaining about the Caesar's conduct. But though Florentius was the emperor's picked man, Constantius decided in this case to side with Julian. Taxes were reduced in Gaul by something like two-thirds, and officials stopped allowing the wealthy to defer their payments. The result was a double boon. The lower classes thrived because they had less taxes to pay, and tax revenues increased because the rich were paying their fair share. Not a bad day's policymaking. The success of Julian's proposal was not enough to endear him to Florentius, though, especially because as the summer of 358 arrived, Julian ran another of the prefect's policies off the rails. Since the revolt of Magnentius, the Franks had incrementally increased their power along the northern coast of Gaul, until, by this point, they basically controlled the English Channel. This was, of course, a serious strategic issue for the Romans, as it meant that supply lines from Britannia were not at all secure, which is why Julian had to rely on shipments from the south to feed his army in the north. Florentius's proposal was to just pay the Franks not to attack Roman ships. This straightforward business proposition won Constantius's blessing, but not without a caveat. The emperor wrote to Julian and told the young Caesar to go along with the plan unless he found it, quote, absolutely disgraceful. And to Julian, that's exactly what it was. Without waiting or consulting with anyone, he lined up his troops and marched them north, intent on smashing the Franks and freeing up the grain supply from Britain. It was a risky strategy, especially since feeding his army depended entirely on freeing up those supply lines. But fortune favored his boldness, and after a few weeks on campaign, the Franks were brought to heel, much to Julian's delight and Florentius's chagrin. At the end of this successful operation, though, Julian, standing with his men, once again took a nosedive, when they noticed that in his hurry to get the campaign going, all the supplies they had were the supplies they had on their back. When Julian began to order these supplies dispersed to the string of forts he was building to help keep the area secure, his men started to get very angry very quickly. At first, Julian thought the grumbling was just more grumbling. But a hungry army is a dangerous army, and the Caesar was forced to offer a naked bribe to get the men back in line as they waited for a relief shipment of grain. His troops mollified, Julian ordered the army across the Rhine for a second time, and over the course of the rest of the year, he tracked down two more of the chiefs who had fought him at Strasbourg and forced them, too, to sign a non-aggression treaty. As the winter of 358 approached, Julian was able to survey his province with satisfaction. Despite the fact that he had been either subtly undermined or outright opposed by most of the senior officials in Gaul, the young Caesar had succeeded in stabilizing the Rhine frontier, securing control of the English Channel, and generally seeing to it that the citizens of Gaul could prosper once again. It was right around this point, of course, that his relations with Constantius began to fray. Nothing spells imperial paranoia like the popular success of an underling, and as Julian's reputation grew, so too did the scheming of Constantius's court. Just to set the stage for what's coming next, though, we should note that the rising imperial tensions did not occur in a vacuum. While Julian was off subduing Gaul, Constantius stayed mostly in Milan, popping over to the Danube frontier as need be, and once, get this, even paying a visit to Rome, the first such visit of his life. In 357, though, a troubling embassy arrived from the east. Agents of the Sassanid king Shapur had come to demand that Constantius return all territory ceded to the Romans by the Treaty of Nispus some 60 years earlier. The emperor had no intention of coming anywhere close to agreeing to the ambassador's demands, and he sent them packing with a firm no. That being said, the fact that Shapur had even asked meant that the Persian king had likely secured his northern border and was now turning his attention back to his western border. So Constantius sent an embassy of his own back to Shapur, trying to arrange a peace that did not require Rome to just utterly capitulate. This time, it was Shapur's turn to send the embassy packing with a firm no. War was looming once again. As the spring of 359 arrived then, there were two ways that Constantius could look at the success of his younger cousin in Gaul. He could either be happy that the West seemed locked down right at the moment when the East was about to blow up, or he could be unnerved by the fact that just as he was about to be dragged off to fight a war in the East, his younger cousin was becoming immensely popular in the West. With Constantius off fighting, how long would it be until Julian made a grab for power? Unfortunately for everyone, the one person who would act as a check on Constantius's paranoia was his wife Eusebia, and she was now dead. The Augusta had always liked Julian and defended the young Caesar whenever the emperor's advisors ran the boy down. Now that she was dead, everywhere Constantius turned, men were telling him that Julian was a threat, and so the emperor naturally came to believe that Julian was indeed now a threat. While he was growing more and more paranoid about his Caesar, Constantius was knocked sideways by word that in the east, Shapur had begun a siege of the key fortress city of Amida. The emperor dashed east, but along the way learned that after 73 days, Amida had fallen, and with it had gone 6 legions. Upon reaching the east, Constantius discovered the extent of the damage done by Shapur and realized quickly that he did not have enough local manpower to properly defend the border. So in January of 360, he sent a fateful letter to Julian, a letter that would initiate the final break between the two men. Since Gaul was now relatively peaceful and things were falling apart in Syria, Constantius ordered almost half of Julian's Gallic army to march at once to Syria to help shore up the Eastern Front. Given the circumstances, the order is understandable, but to Julian and his officers, the true reason for the troop redeployment was as plain as day. Julian had gotten too powerful, and Constantius was attempting to neuter him. Neither Julian nor his men knew the full extent of the disaster unfolding in the Far East, and after a year in which relations between Emperor and Caesar had become more and more strained, it was easy for them to jump to the conclusion that something sinister was afoot. Now, I'm not willing to give Constantius a complete pass in all this. Of all the provinces in the empire, he just so happened to demand reinforcements from the one province where the troops were uniformly loyal to Julian. That really does smell like something. But I think that at the end of the day, Julian wound up revolting over a fairly rational military decision. It was probably a non-issue blown way out of proportion. That said, it certainly was not a non-issue to the men of the Gallic legions, especially since Julian had specifically promised them that they would never have to serve beyond the Alps. The army of the late empire was a far more settled force than in previous ages, and all of these men had wives and children and land and interests in Gaul, and they were happy to fight to protect all of that, but they had no interest in being uprooted to go fight in some far-off desert. When news of the order leaked, the soldiers stationed in Paris for the winter immediately demanded to know what Julian was going to do about it, because we are not going to go out and fight Persians. The situation began to quickly spiral out of control as other garrisons heard the news and began to agitate. Julian finally decided that he needed to meet this head-on, so he circulated an order for all the troops to leave their quarters and come to Paris so he could address the issue directly. As each garrison arrived, Julian went out to greet them and attempted to win them over with promises of glory and appeals to their patriotic spirit, but yeah, not so much. He then attempted a compromise, announcing that the soldiers would be allowed to bring their families along if they so desired. This kind of addressed their concerns, but not really. Really, they just really didn't want to go. So then, pamphlets began circulating, and rabble-rousers became more brazen, things were getting ugly, and a full-blown mutiny looked like it was right around the corner. The other senior officials in Gaul recognized the powder keg Julian was sitting on, and most, for either personal or professional reasons, decided that the very best thing they could do was stay the hell out of Paris for a while. So, for example, when Julian wrote to Florentius and requested the prefect come to Paris to help him broker a solution, Florentius alternatively ignored the letters or invented paper-thin excuses to remain where he was. There was no love lost between the two men, and it looked like Julian was about to be consumed by a furious army. Why in the world would Florentius want to get in the way of such a delicious ending to this annoying story? But Julian was not going to go down that easy. As I just mentioned, the assumption within his inner circle was that the redeployment order was all about Constantius taking Julian out at the knees, because the emperor was paranoid and jealous of his younger cousin. So Julian was reminded that there was one solution to this problem that he really ought to consider. And in fact, the way things were going, it was really the only solution on the table if he wanted to keep his head. It was time to play the trump card. So one night in February, Julian and his inner circle got together for dinner and discussed how best to play this trump card. Of course, in Julian's later telling, everything that's about to happen was totally spontaneous and he was taken completely by surprise. But really, as you know by now, that's not really the way these things work. A few hours after the dinner broke up then, Julian was taken completely by surprise as the soldiers spontaneously surrounded his quarters and hailed him as Augustus. But Julian did not immediately appear, and instead let the word go round of what was happening at the imperial residence. The next morning, though, with the troops assembled and expectant, Julian stepped up onto the platform and announced that he could not in good conscience abide by Constantius's order. He would accept their acclamation, become Augustus, and fight for them if they would fight for him. The cheers were immediate and prolonged. Julian was hoisted up on a shield and carried about triumphantly. The revolt had begun. But Julian planned to play this thing carefully. He wrote a letter to Constantius explaining what had happened, that it was all outside of his control, and he even offered a compromise whereby Julian would reinforce the east with troops from Hispania. He even signed the letter Caesar so as to avoid offending the emperor unnecessarily. But when Constantius received the message, this small gesture was lost amidst the furious raging. As with the revolt of Magnentius, though, Constantius was locked down against the Sassanids, and he refused to abandon the east just to go deal with his treasonous Caesar. Again, as with the revolt of Magnentius, this is, I think, to Constantius's credit. All he could do, then, was send a sharp reply denouncing the actions of Julian and the Gallic army. But when Julian read that letter publicly, the imperial minister who had delivered it was forced to hightail it out of Paris at top speed, fearing for his life. The rest of 360 then passed, with letters flying back and forth between the two now rival Augusti. Neither was looking for war, Julian because he was actually in a pretty weak position, and Constantius because of Shapur's continued belligerency. But neither would either back down. Julian asserted his independence, and Constantius denied it. So whether they wanted it or not, eventually war was going to come. So while the letters flew, both prepared. Julian secured the support of the British legions, and then spent the year campaigning against the Germans to ensure that they would remain passive should he wind up marching east. Constantius, meanwhile, intensified his recruitment efforts while simultaneously looking to cut a deal with the Persians to temporarily suspend hostilities. It was not until early 361, though, a full year after Julian's elevation, that war truly became inevitable. As Julian fought a suddenly emboldened army of Alemanni, he captured communications that made it very clear that the Germans were being prompted to action by Constantius. This revelation, coupled with news that the war machine the emperor was assembling in the east was not necessarily being assembled to fight the Persians, led Julian to the conclusion that he had better act now or risk annihilation. By June of 361, Julian's mind was made up. He was going to go on the offensive. He gathered up 23,000 men, the most he felt he could spare, and then divided them into three columns, two of 10,000 men to be led by subordinates, and the last column of 3,000 to be led by Julian personally. These three columns then sped east along different routes, hoping to fly further under the radar and travel at a faster pace than one giant army would be able to do. Mostly the strategy worked, except for the fact that when Julian arrived at Sirmium, where everyone was supposed to link up, he was the only one there. With the Sirmium garrison alerted to Julian's offensive and his backup still en route, the rebel Augustus had to think fast. His solution was brilliant. A small detachment of soldiers snuck into the city and made their way to the commander's bedroom. Before anyone knew what had happened, the leader of the city was captured and snuck back into Julian's tent. Once there, the captured commander was told that Julian meant him no harm, but it was probably in his best interest to stand down Sirmium and allow Julian to take the city. The commander, with his back now personally against the wall, reluctantly agreed, and Julian entered Sirmium unopposed. Once the rest of his army showed up, Julian ordered the Sirmium legions redeployed to Gaul, where they were to keep an eye on the now weakly defended Rhine frontier. It seemed like a good idea in theory, neutralize a force whose loyalty could not be counted on, while simultaneously shoring up the rear. But the Sirmium troops were not the least bit happy about being sent to Gaul, and so while passing through northern Italy, they revolted and captured Aquileia. Okay, well, that's not good. With his military offensive going well, but not perfectly, Julian then went on the offensive politically, writing to the leadership of Rome and the various cities of Greece, defending his actions and denouncing Constantius. The only problem was that Constantius was actually wildly popular in Rome and the various Greek cities. Julian's overblown rhetoric rang false, and rather than ginning up support for his cause, the letters left him further isolated. As well as this adventure had begun, it was now starting to unravel. His aim had probably been to capture Constantinople before Constantius left the east, but then the real heavy news dropped. Constantius had made a deal with the Sassanids and was already marching west. Bottled up in the middle of the empire with his supply lines to Gaul cut off and political support non-existent, Julian was looking doomed. What he needed was a miracle. Then, in November of 361, a miracle. Constantius and his army had made it as far as the Cilician gates when the emperor came down sick. Unwilling to stop, he ordered the army to press on, but by the end of the next day, the shocking news began to spread. Constantius II was dead. He was 44 years old and had been in Augustus for 24 years. Following right on the heels of this shocking news was the even more shocking news that despite the fact that they were about to fight each other to the death, Julian was still listed in Constantius' will as the sole and rightful heir to the empire. So now, far from having to fight his way to Constantinople, the road to the capital was wide open. Julian, who had been raised a forgotten exile, was now the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. Next week, we will see what he does now that he wields so much power. And I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with why we call him Julian the Apostate. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 145, Julian the Apostate. In November of 361 AD, Constantius II died, and Julian, last of the Constantinians, inherited the empire. It would be an ironic end to the dynasty. At least, I'm pretty sure it's ironic. Sometimes I think that no situation actually fits the technical definition of irony, and that the word just sort of hangs out in the linguistic ether, singing a siren song that's designed to crash the unsuspecting against the jagged rocks of pedantry, but I'm pretty sure it's ironic. Constantine began the dynasty by single-handedly launching Christianity to prominence, and his nephew would end it by attempting to single-handedly turn back the clock and bury Christianity. That's ironic, right? It sure seems ironic, but it's probably just interesting. When Julian received word that his cousin was dead, I have to imagine that it took a few minutes for the news to sink in. Here he was, hunkered down in Thrace and ready to make what was very possibly shaping up to be his last stand, and instead, Constantius is dead, and I am now emperor. Like an approaching hurricane that just sort of transforms at the last moment into a pleasant sunny day, it takes a second to fully appreciate what the heck has just happened. But after the first few minutes of blinking wonder passed, Julian wasted no time completely embracing his imperial windfall. It appears that he had been thinking for a while about what he would do if he became emperor, because as soon as he became emperor, Julian jumped right into a completely out-of-left-field program of reform with both feet. Many critics of the new emperor note, though, that while his enthusiasm is laudable, maybe Julian should have looked before he leaped. Now the unopposed master of the empire, Julian entered Constantinople on December the 11th, 361 AD, and immediately got down to it. The first order of business, of course, was to completely overhaul the imperial court. Stalking the halls of the palace were men who were not just venal and corrupt, but men who had actively opposed Julian. Men who had consistently tried to talk Constantius into killing him. These men needed to be identified and purged. Aware that it might look bad if he just showed up and started arbitrarily killing people, Julian gave his purge the air of objectivity by appointing an independent commission of 6 trusted men to sort through the roles and separate the good men from the bad men. The emperor even went so far as to situate this commission across the Sea of Marmara in the town of Chalcedon, so that the verdicts would not originate from the imperial palace itself. But I doubt that anyone was too fooled by this superficial independence. The worst of the emperor's enemies were executed, and the rest were exiled. It wasn't hard to see the invisible hand of Julian guiding the commission's decisions about who needed to go and who could stay. But beyond the strictly personal personnel decisions, the commission also included among the guilty men who were just plain old bad eggs. Constantius's court had a reputation for corruption, and the idealistic Julian appears to have been genuinely interested in purging the imperial roles of the worst of the worst. But Julian was not done when the commission wrapped up its business. For all the attention his religious policies receive, religious policies that we'll get to in a minute, it is worth noting that Julian was not just trying to turn the clock back on the church. He was also trying to turn it back on the state. Julian clearly idolized the emperors of the Antonine dynasty and sought to base his own administration on their example. The first thing he attacked was just the sheer bloat of the imperial court. The Golden Age emperors had not needed 50 chefs and 30 secretaries and a personal barber, so why did he? Pink slips started flying through the palace, and anyone deemed unnecessary, redundant, or useless was simply given the boot. But firing all the leeches was just the beginning of Julian's attempt to turn back the clock to the hundreds AD. In a far more dramatic and far more disruptive move, the emperor also began to abandon the whole emperor as a living god conceit. He shed the massive smokescreen of officials standing between him and his subjects. He ate simple foods and wore simple clothes. He grew a philosopher's beard. Clearly, Julian wanted to pretend like the epoch-shifting reforms of Diocletian had never happened, and return to the princeps model of governance. In Julian's head, these were virtuous reforms that would be embraced by a public weary of overblown imperial egos. But mostly, the public was just bewildered. It would have been like Vespasian emerging from the civil wars of 69 AD and suddenly announcing that the Republic was back in effect. No one would have had any idea how to act, how to deal with it, or what was even expected of them. The entire political system of the late empire was centered around a quasi-divine emperor who inhabited the realm between man and God. To have an emperor suddenly joining in Senate debates, expressing emotion in public, and just sort of generally being around, well, it was massively disconcerting. Julian meant well, but his vision was hopelessly anachronistic. When he died, the mere mortals of the empire gratefully ran back into the paternal embrace of their once again quasi-divine emperor. While he was bringing the role of emperor back down to earth, Julian also attempted to reduce the public power of the imperial bureaucracy in general. Adopting a more Trajan-like worldview, Julian believed that the central government was there to focus on the big picture issues like defense and taxation. It was not there to micromanage the affairs of every city, town, hamlet, and farmhouse in the empire. Seeking to devolve political authority, Julian re-empowered the ruling councils of the cities and handed over jurisdiction of huge tracts of imperial land to these local magistrates. The idea was to get them involved in the decision-making process so Julian himself was not bogged down by endless minutiae. But once again, the citizens of the empire were more bewildered than anything else. Had Julian lived longer, this might all have eventually sunk in. But in the year and a half he ruled, he mostly just spun his wheels, trying to convince the leading men of various cities that being a magistrate wasn't just a massive financial burden anymore, that real power and real authority was theirs for the taking. They remained skeptical, though, until Julian's death ended the argument, and the rich and powerful men of the empire continued their drift into rural feudalism undisturbed. To the energized 29-year-old emperor, however, these reforms were not yet doomed to failure, and he really felt like he was just getting started on a complete overhaul of the empire's political constitution. He had no way of knowing that because he was about to die, none of this was going to stick. We don't really have any idea what would have happened had Julian lived, and it is one of the great speculative questions of Roman history. Maybe the institutional barriers would have been too great to overcome in the end, but then again, maybe 30 years of Julian really would have been revolutionary. Which brings us to the heart and soul of Julian's short reign, the heart and soul of Julian the Apostate. As I mentioned two episodes back, Julian had secretly rejected Christianity around 350 AD, not long after being released from his Cappadocian exile. But until now, this rejection had been a behind-closed-doors sort of thing. Close friends and advisors were aware of Julian's religious preferences, but since there was no upside to publicizing these religious preferences, it was a secret that stayed with his close friends and advisors. Now that he was king of the hill, though, Julian was free to bring his paganism out into the open, and boy, did he ever bring it out into the open. From the minute he became emperor, Julian worked obsessively to tear down the socio-political influence of the Christians, or, as Julian liked to call them, the Galileans, a subtle dig based on a quote from the Gospel of John that, out of Galilee, ariseth no prophet. But Julian knew that merely tearing down would not be sufficient to fulfill his vision of a re-paganized empire. He would also have to build something up to replace the soon-to-be-displaced Christians. When Julian entered Constantinople in December of 361, he immediately began this dual program of tearing down Christianity and building up paganism. It goes without saying that the political purge that accompanied Julian's arrival in the capital was driven in part by religious motives. In other words, the Christians were to be kicked out of influential posts, denied access to the imperial purse strings, and denied access to the emperor personally. Since the previous regime of Constantius had been so overtly Christian, though, this basically meant getting rid of everyone, something even Julian found he couldn't bring himself to do. So the apostate emperor wound up retaining a handful of the most honest and capable Christians in his administration. Beyond these token few, though, if you were Christian, your civil service career was suddenly in jeopardy. Now, of course, the swiftness with which Julian was able to reorganize the inner circle of the imperial government could not be matched on a system-wide basis. The bureaucracy was simply too large and too dispersed to overhaul overnight. But Julian was taking the long view on this thing, and so he promulgated a discriminatory order that when jobs opened up, the God-fearing candidates, that is, pagans, were to be preferred over the atheists, that is, the Christians. For the ambitious civil servant, this had to be a frustrating development. Like a week ago, they told me I had to be Christian if I wanted this job, and now you're telling me that because I'm a Christian, I'm not going to get the job? I don't really care one way or the other. I just wish you guys would get your story straight. On the building up front, Julian turned his attention first to building up in the literal sense. He ordered all the old shrines and temples and sanctuaries that had been closed over the years to be reopened, and appropriated imperial funds to help defray the costs. But, knowing that the central government would not be able to afford to cover even a fraction of the total costs that this order would generate, Julian issued an addendum edict that was one part practical and one part punitive. Under the previous Christian regimes, citizens had been encouraged to destroy the blasphemous sanctuaries of the pagans, or, at the very least, to repurpose them into something more useful. So all these old pagan buildings became shops and warehouses, and in some cases, family apartments. Julian ordered that the men responsible for the destruction or repurposing of the temples be responsible for the costs of undoing the damage they had done. Even Julian's most ardent admirers are troubled by the real-world effects of this edict. The empire had been Christian for 40 years now, so in many cases, families and businesses had absorbed the old pagan holy places a really long time ago. Their lives and livelihoods had become tied, at imperial encouragement no less, to the discarded husks of what they had been assured were dead cults. Now, suddenly, Julian wanted to kick them out and make them pay to rebuild the houses of said dead cults. It was unfair in theory and cruel in practice. But Julian pushed on undeterred, and in February of 362, about 4 months after donning the purple, he issued his famous, or infamous, depending on who you talk to, Edict on Religious Tolerance. The point of the edict was to officially overturn the anti-pagan laws that had been on the books since the reign of Constantine. Now, those laws, which banned sacrifice, had never been uniformly or even diligently enforced. But still, officially, they were out there, and so Julian officially canceled them. Using the same sort of language Constantine had once used himself in the Edict of Milan, Julian declared that all religions were now to be considered equal in the eyes of the government. This meant that all the secret pagans or lapsed pagans or whoever could now return to their old ways without fear of state sanction. It also meant, though, that Christianity was not illegal. Given everything we know about Julian the Apostate, one might assume that the first thing he did was ban the Galilean religion outright. But his plans were a bit more subtle, a bit more long-term, and a bit more rational than his name might imply. The utter failure of the Great Persecution was not exactly ancient history. Julian knew that, far from breaking the Christians, that violent repression only led to a hardening of their resolve. So his edict was designed to unleash upon them their very worst and most hated enemy in all the world, other Christians. Julian's Edict of Toleration meant that the 40-year-old policy of using imperial muscle to back up what, for lack of a better word, I'll call mainstream Christianity, was over. All those repressed heresies were now free to come out of the woodwork and preach their own particular brand of the one true faith. Just at the moment when the Christian community needed to unite in the face of Julian's attacks, its ranks were sowed with discord. In Julian's perfect world, he would never have to do anything so dramatic as destroy Christianity. Instead, they would just slowly but surely tear themselves apart. Probably the nicest thing about this toleration strategy was that it enabled Julian to maintain the moral high ground. He pointedly declared that no religious violence would be accepted, no matter who the perpetrator or who the victim. Pagans were not to attack Christians. Christians were not to attack pagans, and Christians were not to attack each other. Thus, Julian was able to avoid being painted as some monster a la Galerius or Maximinus Dia. Because I just want everyone to get along. What's wrong with everyone getting along? Come on, can't we all just get along? But just because he encouraged nonviolent means of achieving his goal, that did not mean that Julian's goal was not to drive Christianity into the ground. His goal, most definitely, was to drive Christianity into the ground. In May of 362, Julian left Constantinople and headed for Antioch. Since he had originally established his bona fides in the west, it was important for the new emperor to reach out to the eastern provinces and consolidate his rule over the whole empire. The east, after all, had been Constantius's domain for almost a quarter of a century, and Julian had come to power in the middle of a revolt against the man the eastern provincials had happily called Augustus all those years. In other words, Julian had some making up to do. On top of this political rationale, Julian also had a military rationale for heading east. The war with the Persians that Constantius had broken off was still hanging out there unresolved, and Julian wanted to use that war to cement his imperial authority. A big win over the Persians would catapult him to a whole new level. Not only would he earn the respect of the Eastern legions, who had just months before been marching out to crush him, but he would also establish himself as a military leader of unparalleled skill. He could already point to major victories in the West, add major victories in the East, and boy, he might just become bigger than Constantine. On the road to Antioch, Julian issued another one of his famous/infamous anti-Christian edicts. Henceforth, Christians would not be allowed to teach children using any of the classical texts. That meant no Homer, no Cicero, no Plato. But of course, the basic curriculum of Roman education, philosophy and grammar and rhetoric, used all of those works as their standard textbooks. If you can't teach Homer, you can't teach grammar. It's just that simple. The edict thus presented the parents of the empire with a stark choice. Their kids could either be taught by Christian teachers, but be denied the standard education, or they could be given the standard education and be denied any Christian interpretation of the material. Since a classical education was still required if you wanted to have any sort of decent career, Julian was banking that the vast majority of parents would choose to abandon Christian teachers rather than have their children grow up not knowing who Achilles was. To put this another way, Julian passed a law essentially strangling off Christian access to impressionable young minds. Like I say, he wanted to drive Christianity into the ground. When he arrived in Antioch in July of 362, though, Julian finally ran into some pushback to all this. He came into the eastern capital under the mistaken assumption that the city was eager to shed its Christian veneer and return to its pagan roots. But that was really not the case, as the fracas over the nearby Temple of Apollo would make abundantly clear. Julian went to visit the famous temple shortly after his arrival and was dismayed at the dilapidated condition he found it in. When he ordered a priest to join him at the site for a sacrifice, he was further incensed to see the disinterested priest wandering up with a leftover goose to offer Apollo rather than a nice fat bull. Julian then consulted the oracle of the temple in order to gain some much-needed mystical advice, but was told that as long as the dead were desecrating the temple grounds, that the oracle could not speak. In this case, the dead referred to a famous Christian martyr who had been buried near the temple grounds. Julian figured it would be no big deal to exhume the body and then move it back to a proper cemetery, but the citizens of Antioch were outraged at this sacrilege. They came out en masse to protest the emperor's decision, and then, just a few days later, the Temple of Apollo mysteriously burned down. The verdict of history is that the fire was probably an accident, caused when some lit candles were neglected. But the verdict of Julian was that the Christians of Antioch were guilty of arson. All of this growing enmity was further exacerbated by another bout of famine, just like the one that had helped take down Julian's brother Gallus. The emperor attempted to set price controls on the now scarce grain supply. But all that happened was that rich merchants bought up all the available food at the controlled price and then carted it off to the surrounding countryside, where they sold it at an insane markup. Between the religious conflict, the famine, and the just downright incompatibility of Julian and the Antiochians, they liked sumptuous living and games, he liked plain living and philosophy, it soon became clear that this was a relationship that was just never going to work. At a set of games thrown by Julian, against his will of course, the Antiochians went in for a particularly harsh round of heckling that left the emperor embarrassed and embittered. He responded by publicly disseminating a satirical work called The Beard Hater, in which he viciously lampooned the citizens of Antioch while pretending to make fun of himself. No one really comes off well in the exchange, and the final upshot of it all is that when the emperor finally left the city in March 363, he promised never to return. His encounter with the Antiochians, though, did not cause him to reassess his religious policies, so much as cause him to dig in his heels. In January of 363, Christians were banned from practicing law. In February, the Christian custom of daytime funerals was prohibited. But as I said, Julian was not just about tearing down. In the middle of all this, he also made an energetic, if futile, attempt to unify all the various pagan cults into a single organized religion, something that could structurally compete with Christianity. Julian could see how the empire-wide network of Christians helped cement its place in the hearts and minds of the citizens, how their dedication to helping the poor, tending to the sick, and offering sanctuary to the lost made them so popular with the common people, and most of all, how their unity, despite their many differences, made them an institutional force to be reckoned with. So Julian tried to create a pagan alternative to the Christian church. According to his plans, high priests would act as bishops, lower priests would act as presbyters and deacons, and social outreach would become a central part of everyone's religious duties. The emperor even made a hurried stab at creating an overarching metaphysical, philosophical framework for all these cults to live in together. But it was a hopeless cause, because, first of all, the emperor did not have time to properly flesh out his ideas. Second, maybe he didn't have the intellectual chops to even pull it off had he had the time. And third, was a position paper really going to suddenly bind together religious cults that had never had anything to do with each other? There was no such thing as capital P paganism. It's just a word that we use to describe a collection of practices and traditions that had all built up independently of each other over time. You can't just throw them all together and say, now you're just one thing. Julian wanted the final fight to be a one-on-one affair, Christianity versus traditional polytheism. But the very nature of that polytheism precluded the emperor's vision from ever becoming a reality. It was always going to be Christianity versus a whole bunch of small, disunited cults. But whether it would have worked or not doesn't really matter. When I say Julian did not have the time to properly flesh out his ideas, I don't just mean that he was really busy and didn't have time to focus on philosophy. As I'm sure you know, Julian is about to die and leave all of this work unfinished. However, it would not be his war with Christianity that would bring him down, but rather his far more mundane and worldly war with Persia. Next week, the emperor will take to the field ready to score a victory against the Sassanids. But unfortunately, beyond score a victory, he didn't seem to have much strategic direction. What would a victory even look like? Did he want to sack the capital? Beat Shapur in a big battle? Remove Shapur from power completely? Conquer the whole of Persia? What? No one really knew what the ultimate objective was, And it may have been the case that Julian himself did not even know what the ultimate objective was. The emperor liked to jump into things with both feet. And once again, it appears that he really should have looked before he leaped.